everybody. Welcome to Viewing Angles, the only movie podcast. It's me, Dan Leo. And with me, as always, is my trusty companion,
Robert Mecki.
And we're going to be breaking down the box office right into here. We'll be talking about the highest grossing movie of the weekend coming up, 1917, the Sam Mendes directed war epic. And boy, we've got some thoughts about it. So stay tuned for that. But for now, the box office, 1917, as I said, came in first with a $37 million gross, which is pretty good.
That is, especially for a January film.
Technically January. Wow. Yeah, usually the dumping
January
ground.
R-rated war film. Pretty good.
Yeah, and I think this is definitely helped out by the Golden Globes.
Yeah, I was going to say, it definitely got a boost at the last second. I wonder what kind of legs this movie ends up with.
Yeah, I wonder. I don't think people are going to go rewatch this. And I'm not sure if I could really say that a lot of people were jumping out of their seats to like recommend this movie to other people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's one of those where I was like, y'all got to see 1917 right now. It's good.
I wonder if this is going to last in theaters long enough for like Oscar season to give it another life, another breath of air.
Yeah, I mean, Oscar season is technically now. The show is earlier than ever. I believe it's like the 9th of February.
Yeah, early February.
Yeah, so it's like the weekend before the Super Bowl or something like that. So it's exciting. It's exciting, but I really don't know how this is going to do. But already, like, total gross of, you know, like $39 million in total. That's pretty good for like an R-rated war movie, a World War One movie.
What was the budget for this movie?
I can't imagine it must have been decent, but it can't have been too high just knowing that it's a war movie. I don't think the budget has been released yet, but you know, worldwide $66 million, that's not bad at all. So
I wonder, you think over under $100 million, because there aren't that many names. Like, there's really like no big names in this film other than, like, you know,
other than all of them
is essentially a cameo.
Yeah. Every big name is just a cameo for like 2 minutes.
Yeah. And there's only two big names.
Yeah. You know, there's Colin Firth.
Benedict Cumberbatch.
Then there's Richard Madden and Andrew Scott.
Oh, I forgot Richard Madden. Yeah, he was right at the very end. Andrew Scott, I don't know who that is, though.
Yeah, that's a hot priest from Fleabag.
See, I don't watch Fleabag, so.
Yeah, so when you watch Fleabag, you'll be able to understand why everyone was like, ooh, this guy is so good.
Okay.
He was cool. Moriarty in Sherlock.
Oh, that's where I recognized him from.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, every British actor is in this film.
Yeah, and the guy who plays Blake is Tommen from Game of Thrones.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
One of the main characters, yeah.
Wild. He's grown so much.
Well, yeah, look at all these famous people who are just popping up in this movie.
Yeah, all these Game of Thrones actors.
Yeah, but we'll talk about that more in a little bit. But let's get into the second movie, which, of course, is Star Wars The Rise of Skywalker. Taking another big hit. It's $15 million. It's about to cross 1 billion, so that's something.
Yeah, but so Disney still wins.
Disney still wins. They've, I mean, who knows? They already made their money back, I'm sure, like tenfold.
Merchandising alone, they've made the money back from this film.
Yeah, from their deal with United Airlines, I'm sure they've made the money back. So that's exciting, but it's 15 million. It's dropping low. I can't imagine this. There's no real counter programming to this, except if we're counting Doolittle for like families to go see.
I mean, I guess maybe if for some reason Doolittle turns out to be good, maybe.
I think if it were good, we would know that it's good by now.
Yeah.
It's coming out in like 3 days.
Pushing those reviews out immediately. Yeah.
But it doesn't look very good. It was made for like $175 million. I'd be surprised if that takes in $15 million, maybe $20 million. Yeah.
You know, I could honestly see Jumanji, which is number three. We're just going to skip to it
because
there's not much more to say about Star Wars. But I could see Jumanji at some point beating The Rise of Skywalker at the box office. So I think that this movie has more legs and just more general mass appeal than Star Wars, considering how toxic and divided the fan base of Star Wars has grown. Mm-hmm. And since the, you know, reception to this film has not been the most positive, Jumanji seems like everybody like likes it well enough And if people are just looking for family fare or just like a reason to spend some time at the theater, I think they would rather go see Jumanji than watch Star Wars
again. Yeah, you think so? I mean, that's, it could potentially. It's, I don't know about how much legs it has. If people are going to go rewatch, I know people are going to watch Star Wars again, no matter what. It's already made way more than Jumanji. And
oh yeah.
But I wonder, like, is Jumanji the type of thing where if you haven't seen it in like the first month, that you're going to go see it again, especially after, like, I think Robert Downey Jr. could probably like get enough families into theaters to see him talk to animals
more than Dwayne Johnson and Jack Black and Kevin Hart.
Yeah. After a month. Yeah.
I think Jumanji is a movie, because I think the reason the first one performed so well, not because it had a massive opening weekend, but because it had legs and it was just a movie that was easy to recommend to people who maybe don't go see movies all that often, or again, just want to kill some time at the theater. They're like, oh, I forgot this movie was, or I didn't realize Jumanji was still playing.
True. Yeah. And I think a lot of its legs also come internationally. So we'll see. I mean, its domestic opening was about 60K about a month ago. So that checks out, like dropping by 50%, mm-hmm. maybe a little bit less each week. So we shall definitely see. I'm interested to see how Doolittle performs.
Yeah.
But yeah, let's get into the news of the week. Highs, lows, the toss up. And first we'll get in the high, which I think this is a pretty big high, is that new Birds of Prey movie, Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous the Emancipation of the Fantabulous Harley Quinn, right?
Yeah, close enough.
Close enough. It was rumored for a long time to be R, but we all thought that Warner Brothers, being the cowards that they are, would want it to be PG-13 so they can make money, especially in China. And I really think this is the Joker effect.
I think they would have cut this movie. I think they would have pulled a Sony and a Venom and cut an R-rated movie down to PG-13 if Joker hadn't performed like it did.
Yes, I completely agree. And I think hopefully this is a signal that maybe some of these, not edgier, but these one-off movies for Warner Brothers will be a little bit more gritty, like grittier, more intense. They'll have more freedom, the directors will, to make the movie that they want. We're going to get maybe like a 90s renaissance of R-rated comic book movies.
Oh,
like
God,
we had with
so.
Blade and Spawn.
That is the dream.
That's the dream, especially with people who kind of grew up on those.
Yeah. Now the
stuff.
People who liked those franchises so much are the ones like with the power in the director's chairs. I think we're going to like James Gunn's Suicide Squad sequel/reboot. I don't know how they're defining it yet. Mm-hmm. Is also very heavily rumored to be rated R, which I think would be great. I think that movie has to be rated R. And I think that James Gunn's sense of humor really plays to that type of. Mm-hmm. You know, the edgier crowd, I guess.
Yeah, the real edgelords.
Totally.
I think that's a good point. And I think just if this movie performs well, it'll give a lot of creators who are maybe frustrated at the Marvel system right now. Mm-hmm. Scott Derrickson, who's going
to
be the director.
He's coming to DC. Yeah. He is coming to DC. Also, it's not on the docket, but Scott Derrickson left Doctor Strange Multiverse of Madness, which is very disappointing. But I do think that he's going to come to DC and direct like either a Constantine movie or a Justice League Dark movie, give it that hard R, because he wants to do a superhero horror movie. That's what he wanted to do with Multiverse of Madness. And Kevin Feige just wasn't having it.
Yeah. So now he is off the project and we can only assume looking for another job. And maybe if Warner Brothers figures out, oh, we can attract some higher level talent, if not that Marvel is not already attracting high level talent, but if we give everyone a little bit more freedom to push the boundaries, know that we're not the mouse, we are not Disney.
Yeah.
We can have some, we can fill up a marketplace that really has got nothing going for right now, and capitalize on their own little niche. I hope that happens. I'm excited for it. I hope Birds of Prey does really well. It looks very interesting. So I'm all in.
Yeah, I think it'll do well, too. I think just the power of Harley Quinn, like Harley Quinn sells. even if the box office performance, you know, if this movie doesn't hit $1 billion like Joker did, they're going to make money on all the merch. Like, Hot Topic is probably having a field day right now with all the merch promo they're getting set up for the launch of this movie.
Oh, definitely. I think this is going to be very popular, especially among, if I was, you know, in high school, I would be gearing to see this.
Oh,
I'm already,
yeah.
You know, I'm in my 20s. I'm gearing to see it now. I think it'll be exciting to see maybe a little bit more of an expanded universe that, you know, it took. DC was the first to have a solo female superhero movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're already blowing past Marvel in terms of the quality. And giving women creative control of these movies as well.
Oh, so, yeah. You love to see it.
Yeah, love to see it. And this kind of helps us transition into our low, which came out with Oscar nominations. Our low is that no women were nominated for Best Director, kind of again. You know,
yeah.
There's already the conversations about the Oscars being very white. Only one person of color was nominated for a acting award. And I think we can kind of use this to interrogate maybe, like, I think one of the hard parts about this, and a lot of people are talking about on Twitter, is that this was like a stacked category.
Yes,
it's but I think if you're going by pure like Metascore, people are saying, you know, oh, here are the big three movies that I hear mentioned are Little Women, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, and
The Farewell.
Hustlers.
Oh, really?
And the Farewell, actually. Okay. Yeah, you're right. Four movies that did very well, and critically and commercially, and especially Little Women, which has one of the highest Metascores, I think, of any movie this year. And there are a lot of movies that did very well this year with the critics. And I think that's kind of the main thing, is that let's break down. So who's nominated for Best Director? We've got Tarantino. We got Martin Scorsese. We've got Bong Joon-ho, which that's a win. The Bong is nominated. And we have the Todd Phillips.
We do have Todd Phillips for Joker.
Right. And Sam Mendes for 1917.
That's it. So Noah Baumbach wasn't.
Correct. And this is the tough part, because you feel like there should be more people in here. You have so many Best Picture nominations that to leave some of these directors out feels a little weird. And I'm wondering, should we be expanding like the Best Director category a little further, or should it stay the same limit as all of the other movies? It feels like they expanded the only reason they expanded the best picture category
was so that they could get Black Panther in there.
Right. Like 5 years later, was to make it so that the argument would be, if there are more nominations, more people there are more movies to watch.
Yeah.
Better exposure. Should we possibly think about expanding some of these categories so that more people can get nominated, there's more representation within it? I don't know if that would necessarily make the ceremony last a lot longer if we added one more nominee on a director, supporting actor, supporting actress, you know, those ones.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it'd be that hard. I think that, you know, they already do some awards just on the fringes, or there's some awards they can get through pretty quickly. I think, you know, adding a few more would add seconds to the actual ceremony, because you're reading an extra name off.
Right.
You know, there's not that much hype behind the nomination. So I don't see why we couldn't expand the Best Directing category to include, you know, at least as many as the Best Picture. I think that would actually that makes sense, in my opinion. But I also wonder, I think this is a more interesting question, and I don't know if there's a nuanced way to talk about it, but is there, why do we have separate gender nominations for like performance, but nothing else?
That's a good question. I don't know. That you'd have to go probably to like the the beginning to find out why they would do that. I assume there are other award shows that also break things up by man and woman. But you're saying that maybe we should just have a best supporting actor and best supporting actor, best actor.
And well, I mean, I wasn't even like, if you wanted to shorten the show, like, sure, you could do that. Although I think that would make things more difficult. Or we could just create a new category or separate these categories into best male director and best female director.
Yeah. And I think that it would be a harder pitch than I think combining the categories.
Yes.
Because, and I think Chris Rock brought it up in a monologue when he hosted the Oscars, that it doesn't make sense for actor and actress to be broken up by gender. Because it's not like it's sports. It's like you're playing the same game. You've got the same tools. So why should we break these performances up?
Yeah.
I don't think that would be a bad idea. Although I do foresee any conversations about diversity in the Academy nominations would immediately get way worse.
Yes. Yeah. We'd only be reducing it.
Yeah. So I don't know. And that's also part of, you know, the people obviously want to hear like, this is a meritocracy and the best things are getting nominated. To me, it makes sense that while I think Greta Gerwig probably, I haven't seen Little Women yet, but I think Greta Gerwig probably did a better job than Todd Phillips on Joker. The Academy famously is wrong all the time.
Yeah.
And while I don't think Joker will last the test of time as far as cinema goes, I think that it plays to how the Academy would run this. And it makes sense that Tarantino, Bong Joon-ho, Martin Scorsese, and Sam Mendes all get nominated for Best Director. Mm-hmm. I can't really, if I had to put more people into that, I think Greta Gerwig might be the only one who would make it through.
Haven't even seen Little Women yet.
Correct, yeah, but just judging by how well it was received. Because what you got here, I guess, is Sam Mendes might be the standout because there is a certain finesse required in that movie. It's like a lot of directing. Yeah,
it's a technical achievement for sure.
Yes, exactly. Scorsese is a legend, and this is seen as kind of a retrospective on his gangster opi of yonder year. And Bong Joon-ho, one of the best directors making movies right now.
Yeah, finally getting some Western recognition.
Yeah, people saying this is his masterpiece. That makes sense. That's actually like a win. And I feel like you could also put the Safdies in here and you could also put Greta Gerwig in here. Not sure who else you would put in here that would make sense.
Yeah, there's a lot to deliver. I think you probably could add more in here. Honestly, I do think that just expanding the category is the best option. I don't see any reason why we couldn't just add like three or four more names to this. Just to satisfy people.
Right. Yeah. Just to get more representation out there. And I understand that people already don't want when they hear add things to the Oscars, they say no. Like, let's please not do that. The ceremony's already so long. But I honestly think that without having the host, it kind of tunes things up a little bit. Things move a little faster. I think that's kind of how this should be going. And if they can take a few seconds off, take a minute or so off by not having a host, then put in some more categories put in more nomination slots for Best Director and maybe even the actor categories as well.
I think do that. You could, you know, plenty of fat to trimmer on the show. Give people less time to be thankful because nobody says anything interesting in those speeches anyway.
Yeah, they just thank their agents and get off the stage.
Exactly. I think that, you know, no host does speed things up quite a bit. There's less time on like shitty Jimmy Kimmel bits that they spend on the show. And I think that there are, you know, they already have some awards that they kind of just do on the side, like that they award during commercials or something. You can add a few more like below the line award categories to that. I think the trade off would be worth it to get, you know, more and more representation in these categories and also add the best stunt Oscars. I think that's something that the Oscar should have added years ago. Stunt people get no recognition in Hollywood. That's a category that needs to be added as soon as possible.
Yeah, so it'd be like best stunt coordination.
Yeah. Stunt coordination, stunt performance.
Take out original song.
Combined mixing, combined sound mixing and sound editing.
Like they did with like makeup and hairstyling a while back.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's tough. Yeah. What is technical? What is not? What do people actually want to see? They want to see the actors, the writing, the directing.
Yeah.
The technical stuff, they don't care as much.
Yeah. If you're doing like, or at least just like, you know, do that. Give those awards out during the pre-show.
Yeah. Also, best animated film. Get that out of it. Like what? Just make it's best picture.
It's best kids movie. Like that's what it is. Just combine it with best picture. The movies deserve it. Like, best animated film is just a great film in general. Spider-Verse should have been up for best picture last year.
Yeah. So we've reached the consensus that the Oscars has some work to do.
The Oscars has some work to do. They're pretty fucking broken.
Yeah. But that's all we got on that topic. We'll be talking about it more as the Oscars slowly approach us and January gives us nothing to watch.
Yeah, so, we'll be back once Joker wins all 11 awards it was nominated for.
Jeez, yeah. Hey, but I don't have to eat a glob of wasabi. Cats was not nominated for Best Picture.
It wasn't nominated for anything, right?
Correct.
You win. You do not have to eat a glob of wasabi. You dodged a bullet there.
Yeah, exactly. I have won both of these best picture bets. I'm 2-0 on bets that I make way too early in advance.
Hey, you're a betting man. It's in your nature.
Yeah, exactly. I love the danger. This is how I win. All right. And then the toss of this week is that this was actually just broken today, that Billie Eilish has written the newest James Bond theme.
Interesting.
It is very interesting.
And she is 18.
She's the youngest person to ever write a James Bond theme that we know of, you know?
Yeah.
Bet Paul McCartney was getting his kids to write Live and Let Die, kids. And they're like, Dad, I want to go outside. Back to the piano,
not
son.
Not till we have a banger on our hands.
So I'm actually semi-optimistic about this. I think that her style of music could lend to a very like kind of creepy and sneaky almost theme.
I love sneaky James Bond themes.
Exactly, sneaky. So, you know, just some electronic stuff. What are some of the best Bond themes and what are some of the worst Bond themes?
I have a soft spot in my heart for the Jack White Bond theme from Quantum of Solace. Movie's trash. I love that theme.
Really, I think that's one of the worst themes.
Well, yeah, looks like we're ending the podcast right here.
Because you know, it's not just Jack White; it's Alicia Keys too.
Yeah, Alicia Keys can whatever. Jack White is good enough on that song that I'm like,
yeah,
this is good. This is the best part of this movie.
I think that obviously Adele is a highlight.
That's a good one.
And Goldfinger, also a classic.
Oh yeah, I mean, we were just talking about it. Live and Let Die.
Live and Let Die. Amazing.
So good.
And I think the ones that you can't remember are the ones that are bad.
Yes.
Oh, Diamonds Are Forever also. That's a classic too.
What was the one for Casino Royale?
It was You Know My Name by Chris Cornell.
Don't remember. Probably not good.
No, it's pretty good actually.
Disagree. I don't remember it.
That's a good
one.
We've
already set the rules down for what makes a good Bond song, and it's if you remember it or not.
I remember it very clearly. I remember all of them. I remember everything. I think actually Spectre is a really bad one, too.
I kind of like it just because of how it changed. Like, because that was the first entirely male Bond theme in a while.
Since Casino Royale, yeah.
And Sam Smith. I kind of liked it.
Really, I think we have this is where we come that we've got very different opinions on the Bond soundtracks.
On Bond themes. Also, but I'm also just like you're a way bigger Bond fan than I am. Like I've seen maybe a third of the Bond films.
All the good ones.
That's what I try to do. I don't watch bad Bond films.
Yeah,
except Moonraker,
which is oh man, just dynamite. So good. Oh, that's actually based on a real Ian Fleming book. So
oh boy, I want to read that. Juicy novel.
Yeah, how much crazier could it be?
Right. Maybe, set it on the moon.
Yeah. Actually, the unofficial James Bond movie, Never Say Never Again, actually also has a pretty good theme.
Oh, I'll have to look that up. I'll take your word for it.
Never say never. It's great.
I am excited for Billie Eilish, though. I think Billie Eilish is a great artist. And I do think that it seems like, I wonder if this was Cary Fukunaga's call, because it seems like an interesting person had to have sing the Bond theme, but I want to believe he's going to get weird with this one.
Is this movie going to be a train wreck?
There's a chance. There's always
a chance. I'm 80% sure this is going to be, this whole movie's going to be a train wreck.
I thought that Spectre was going to be good, and that movie kind of turned into a train wreck. I'm hoping it doesn't happen two times in a row. But I've thoroughly enjoyed everything Fukunaga's done so far, so I have faith. And I thought the trailer was really good, too.
Yeah, there is like a theory that like every like even James Bond movie is good, and like every even numbered one, and that the Casino Royale was the one to switch the order.
Oh, so now it's every odd one.
Yeah.
So what this was?
This is 25.
Good, nice.
So who knows?
You love to see it.
Yeah.
I'm excited. I am bummed though that the original composer for this movie, Dan Romer, he got kicked off because
and replaced by Hans Zimmer.
Yeah, of course. Like, sure, Hans Zimmer's fine. He makes great thematic music, but Dan Romer soundtracks are unique, and I love them. And I was so excited to hear his like work on Bond, because he has yet to do a soundtrack that I dislike.
What are some of the other soundtracks he's done that you really like?
Beast of the Southern Wild, that I fucking love. He did the soundtrack for Maniac, which is fucking great. He did the soundtrack for Far Cry 5, and I think that the music in that game is like the best aspect of that game. And he's also doing the soundtrack for the new movie from, I think, Brett Zollin, who did Beast of the Southern Wild. It's called Wendy, and it's like Peter Pan told from the perspective of Wendy if she was like an impoverished child in Middle America.
That sounds very interesting. I didn't really like Beast of the Southern Wild, but...
Oh, that's sad. You don't even like the music? What a shame.
Honestly, I can't remember too much about it.
Guess you just take Katrina survivors.
Yeah. Heard it here first, folks.
Breaking news.
Breaking news.
Send your complaints about each other every day.
Care of Brian Williams at NBC.
There you go.
We're back on the Brian Williams train.
We're bringing it back.
For 2020. Yeah. Exactly. 2020, save Brian Williams. All right, let's get into the feature film of the week. It's 1917. Rob and I both saw it in the same theater. He visited me in Chicago.
Ooh, it was
over
great.
This weekend.
Saw an RPX.
Yeah, Regal plus extra.
Experience, yeah.
Yeah. Regal, please, extra dollars.
You got him. You should write for The Onion.
Yeah, so let's set the stage for what this movie is, because it warrants some explanation.
Mm-hmm.
This is a movie about World War One, but the conceit of this movie is that it is shot to look like one single take, more so than Birdman, which famously won Best Editing and didn't win Best Picture. Did Birdman win Best Picture?
Yes, Birdman won Best Picture. I think deservedly so.
Yeah, I like Birdman a lot. So I don't think it didn't win Best Editing then.
Maybe
like
Best
that.
Cinematography.
Yeah. So basically that movie was shot to look like one continuous shot.
Yeah.
This is more several very long takes.
Yes.
It's probably, I counted maybe 5 to 6 long takes in all. Probably like more closely to 6 to 7.
Mm-hmm. And there are like cuts hidden in between those long takes.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Here's the thing, though. I know that like the gimmick of this movie is that it's shot all like it's supposed to be one continuous take. I don't know if that is really if that's come across in the marketing to people other than, you know, film fans who are reading up on the production of this type of stuff. Like the general trailers for this movie just make it look like a standard war film, like a tense, you know, time is the enemy war film. Like, you get the plot of this movie is pretty simple. You have two soldiers who get orders from their commanding officer to deliver a message to another army segment not to attack in the morning because they realize that the German army is setting up a trap for them. So you essentially follow these two characters in real time throughout the evening and night to deliver this message. But I did not realize
hilarity ensues.
Ensues. Yeah.
Right. Lots of gags.
lots of pratfalls. Yeah.
Right.
Lots of,
exactly. Lots of physical this is a very comedy. Serious movie. Yeah. Yeah.
But when I remember seeing the trailer for this a while ago and just thought like, oh, cool. Sam Mendes is a good director. World War One is a setting that is not explored very often in film. And I was like, OK, this just sounds like a cool war movie from a good director. And I didn't realize it was like the conceit of the movie was it's supposed to look like it was all shot in one take until Elmer started explaining to me that, you know, he's reading some articles online about how they filmed this
friend
movie.
Of the pod, Elmer Guardado.
Yes. But I don't think like, you know, my parents, when I told them about this movie, they didn't know it was meant to be in one take. I think most audience members aren't going to realize that it's meant to look like it was shot in one take. And even watching the film, it feels like the gimmick is not that important to the film as a whole.
Right. I want to zero in on kind of something you were saying there about the gimmick of this. Do we think, and, you know, call it a gimmick, call it a framing device, are the long takes successful? Is it worth it to create this movie in a deliberate fashion? Mm-hmm. As these series of long takes and blending them together to make them look like one long take. Does it serve the movie? Does it hinder the movie? Did you notice it? Did you not notice it?
I didn't notice it too much. And this is kind of where, like, I'm very conflicted about it because I don't think that it serves any narrative or thematic purpose to the film. I think it really is more of just like, let's do it because we can.
Yes.
And I think it looks really good. And I think for most of the film, it works very well. Like, there are a couple, you know, obvious cuts and explosions that mask some transitions. And there's one pretty blatant time skip about halfway through the movie that kind of pulled me out. I was like, oh, so we're not even committing all the way to like the one take idea.
Right. We're having one very clear, no ifs, ands, or buts. This is a cut.
Yeah. But I do think that it actually reminded me a lot of Spielberg's one takes, because Spielberg does a lot of one takes that are very subtle and you don't even really notice that, like, the scene you just watched was a one take until you watch some fucking film analysis video on YouTube later.
Right.
I'm like, oh shit, that was really well done. That was very well blocked. And it never calls attention to itself. And I think that's kind of what I got from the filming of this movie. The one take never really called attention to itself, like the format they were presenting it in. I don't think ever like wanted to grab the audience and be like, hey, look at how cool this is. We're doing all this in one take. Like, yes. Pay attention to all the tricky shit we have to get done. I was like, oh, this is a lot more subtle than I was expecting, you know, and compared to something like Birdman, where I think it was intentionally trying to make the audience aware of its filming gimmick or just its framing device as a one take movie. This film kind of felt the, I don't know, like the opposite of Birdman to me, where I'm just like, oh, this is very subtle, very watchable. And it doesn't feel as egregious when they try to do those hidden cuts. Cause I'm like, they're pretty rare and it's also just not that important to the film.
Yeah. And this is shot by Roger Deakins, friend of the pod. Yeah. No, he's one of the most celebrated cinematographers of all time. He's amazing. Done movies like Skyfall, done movies like
Blade Runner,
2049. Just so many. You can look up his filmography and he's brilliant. Right. Dude's got a range is what we're saying.
Yeah.
So I agree with you that it doesn't call attention to itself in the same way that a movie like Birdman, that switching perspectives kind of calls attention to itself. It'll kind of say, all right, we've got our attention here and now we're going to move it over here. And you're going to notice that we're all doing this in one take. This pretty clearly follows two soldiers and from their point of view. And I think not having any insight into what's happening around them most of the time creates tension.
I agree. Yeah. Knowing that they are surrounded by constant danger and not having those angles to view it with is, I think, a good tool for building tension.
Yeah. And it helps us inhabit where they are, how they feel about what's going on. The fact that there is no dramatic irony in this movie. Yeah. There's nothing that we know that the characters do not know.
Yeah, this movie also, I think the filmic technique does give you a really good sense of geography in this film.
Yes. Yes. Like exactly what they're doing, mm-hmm. how they're doing it. It's masterfully made.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, if this movie were shot a different way, would it be as good?
Probably not.
Quote unquote. I agree. The premise and plot are all pretty thin.
Yeah,
and
very
I think
standard war stuff.
Very standard war stuff. You need to get here because someone told you to.
Yeah,
and you're gonna see some bad stuff on the way. I think there are definitely a few scenes that ring very true, or not ring true, but they feel more emotionally ready because you've spent this real time with these characters and what's happening to them,
mm-hmm.
Or to one of them or to both of them, you're really feeling like this is a part of what's going on. It doesn't feel staged.
Yeah.
It feels like this is happening and there's nothing you can do about it. It's just the inevitable march of time, which on one hand feels good when there's these tense situations unfolding that you've seen a million times in war movies. Someone being killed, someone, recovering from being shell shocked, mm-hmm. A bomb going off, stuff like that feels much more apparent because the camera never leaves the side of the characters. I think that's what happens effectively. But to me, some of the best parts of war movies are the downtime when the characters are interacting with each other. And I think that this movie also brings apparent how like boring some of the sequences are when they're just walking around, and it really does feel like a video game, mm-hmm. when there's just canned dialogue as you're like walking.
It's like, oh, it's you walked past this trigger point, like hit that dialogue button.
Right. Yeah, exactly. When they know that, hey, we've got nothing for you to do right now, so these guys are going to have some random conversation.
Yeah.
Sometimes it plays into what happens later. A lot of the times it's just conversation. It wasn't one of the highlights of the movie for me. There were parts that I felt dragged because of the technique, the filming technique that they were using.
Yeah.
And I'm not necessarily sure that the highs of the one take met my kind of ambivalence towards the rest of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think not the cool part about it, but the novelty of it wore off pretty quickly for me. And only kind of came back to the forefront during maybe three or four scenes where I was kind of wondering how they pull this off. This is amazing that they did this.
Yeah.
But that's kind of the ultimate, like, taking me out of the movie is, wow, how did they do this? Unless it's like a stunt that it's like, and there are stunts in this, but most of it is done by the actors and just having these two guys go from waypoint to waypoint, meeting new characters, getting side quests, collecting items. Like, it does feel like a little transactionally, and there's a huge gaping plot hole about how much time it takes them to do all of this.
Yes. I honestly kind of forgot about that, mainly because when I'm watching this movie, I was not thinking about the logistics of it, which is kind of fucked because that is like what the unique way of filming this movie was supposed to bring to it. They're like, oh, you have this many hours, this many minutes to get to where you need to go. And the movie should have been in real time.
Yes.
But because of that, that time skip that happens about midway through the movie, like you said, it loses a lot of its appeal. The novelty wears off, I think, pretty early because there is not a whole lot of there's really not that much action in this movie, and there aren't a whole lot of like breathtaking stunts that mm-hmm. really make you think like, oh, how the fuck did they do this in one take? It's it's pretty easy to see how they did a lot of the scenes in one take because there's usually not that much action happening. Like, there's some big battle sequences towards the end, And they're, you know, at the end, they kind of show in the trailer, but when they're charging on the front, I think that one take sequence is pretty breathtaking. I also do think, though, that the scene immediately after the time skip during the burning, I'll just want to call it the burning church segment.
Yeah,
that is my favorite part of the movie. And I think that might be some of Roger Deakins's best work.
Dude, I think, loves burning stuff at night.
Yes, but also just like the shadow play of the flares going off, and just like the fact that it is one take and you see the shadows rotating around all the structures as the flares dissipate. The music starts swelling. It feels like he just walked into like this surrealist wartime nightmare. Then you have like the faceless soldiers like charging him out of the blue. Like that's the scene that really, I think, put this movie like above average for me. Because I think it's worth seeing this movie alone just for that sequence. I thought that sequence was phenomenal.
Yeah, I think I might have come off a little too harsh. Because this is like a pretty great movie.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure.
But there's so much hype behind it, especially after the Golden Globe win.
There is a lot of hype behind it, and it kind of feels like it's the most movie. It is like it's something easy for Oscar voters to kind of get to, any kind of voter to get behind. It's a war movie. It's shot to look like it's one shot. It's Deakins, Sam Mendes. It's a pretty easy concept. Like, they need to go from this place to this place. It's the triumph of the human spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. There's nothing complicated about this movie.
Yeah. It's not challenging in any sense. But right. It is impressive.
Yes, it is a story of two guys who have to get from point A to point B. Just two dudes to save the lives of a lot of people. And they, you know, we won't spoil the ending, but it turns out fine. You know how World War One happened.
We can't spoil history.
Yeah, it is kind of funny. I thought about this, that they... World War One to World War Two. That at World War Two, they're just like, all right, like no trenches, right? We're completely done with trenches again, right?
Like
exactly.
Trenches every fucking side suck, agreed. Man. Like,
yeah, exactly. That's because you understand the fact that they're living. It does really show some horrors of trench warfare. But you know, is this All Quiet on the Western Front, Paths of Glory, Platoon, Saving Private Ryan? Is this in the pantheon, the Mount Rushmore, if you will, of great war movies?
Probably not. I wouldn't put it in there with those greats.
Yeah.
But, you know, some people may disagree with me, and, you know, maybe some people will have more of an appreciation of the technique behind the film because it is masterful. It's just a shame that the narrative and the character development of the film was not on the same level as the, craft.
Yeah, it's definitely, but I think that's part of it, is that when you decide to do it in this way, that there's a certain level of complexity that your script cannot get beyond.
Yeah.
You know, there are limits to what you can do, and they stretched it. They stretched the limits wholeheartedly and forcefully, that I was pretty impressed, but I just don't think that it really landed in a place that I would consider really amazing. And maybe it's harder because there are so many war movies that exist, and so many of them are amazing, that it's just kind of like, is this worth it? Which I don't necessarily think so.
Yeah. I wonder how this film would have been received if it didn't come out in like prime award season. Like, if this was just, you know, like a March movie, maybe a summer movie, with expectations set a bit lower than they are, how people would feel about it.
Yeah. What do you think is the better dad movie, 1917 or Ford versus Ferrari?
I think Ford v. Ferrari.
Me too. I think I enjoyed Ford versus Ferrari more than I did 1917.
Yeah, Ford v. Ferrari is great. 1917, I'm in no real rush to go back and watch it again. You know, I think it is a movie you can kind of glean everything that the director and the team behind it intended to say. Off of first viewing, I don't think there's a whole lot of depth to this movie.
Yeah, so it's overall enjoyable. I'm not sure if it'll make it into my top 10, but it could. I'm still need to see Little Women and maybe a few other movies as well. I still haven't got my top 10 of 2019 out, which is, it's tough when the movies don't come out, you know, everywhere.
I will say though, I don't want to say this is not a bad movie.
This is not a bad movie. This is a good movie, undisputed. At least like this is like a 4-star movie.
Yeah, I think this
four out of five.
A good movie. I would argue very good movie. And I do think that you should go see this in theaters because the sound of a theater is, I think, very important to the experience as well. But again, it's just I think we're coming off sounding so harsh because of all the praise it's recently gotten.
Yeah. If someone says this is the best movie of the year and then you see it,
I'll fight
and you're
them
like,
on it.
Yeah. I'm still what's kind of in your periphery? What are your like top three just gut level movies of 2019?
Ooh, Parasite, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and this is a tough one. Maybe Little Women.
Oh wait, you saw Little Women?
I did see Little Women. Little Women's fucking great.
It?
It's fucking fantastic. Great. Yeah, we'll talk about it at some point once you go see it.
Yeah. Perfect. Oh well. Yeah. Then I think my top three, because I'm a shill, is Joker. No.
Joker.
Exactly. Yeah, Joker, Endgame, and Star Wars.
Oh boy.
Hi, it's me. I've only seen three movies this year.
Hi, it's me. I've only seen three movies this year, and my favorite food is mac and cheese.
Yeah. I like spaghetti with ketchup.
Fuck you.
Yeah. I think it would probably be Parasite. This is not in our particular order. Parasite, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and The Irishman.
Okay. Not a bad choice. I was thinking about The Irishman, but I'm like, I think I like The Little Women more.
Yeah, I mean, that's something. And I think the ones that are still up for grabs in contention are probably Little Women. And I think that's it. I mean, besides some of like the more esoteric movies that came out this year, which, you know, who knows if I'll end up seeing them. But overall, I think that's I'll have my bases covered once I see Little Women.
Yeah, I think so, too. Excuse me.
Yeah. All right. Well, Rob, what are we going to talk about next week?
Doolittle.
Probably not. What is the other movie we're going to be
talking
about?
We
got to
do it.
We got to do the Doolittle.
Yeah. Oh, you want to talk about Little Women next week?
Yeah, we could. That or Bad Boys for Life. Whatever you
want. Oh, boy. I forgot Bad Boys for Life is coming out. Maybe Bad Boys. We'll play it by ear. But Bad Boys would give us a chance to talk about Bad Boys 2, which I just need to, like, vent about. Because I've never seen that movie before last week, and my roommate and I, Elmer, friend of the show, we're watching Bad Boys 1 and 2 in preparation for the trilogy ender.
Oh, man. So you'd only seen Bad Boys 1. You had never seen Bad Boys 2.
Yes. And I didn't watch Bad Boys 2 because Bad Boys 1 is not good.
Yeah.
Bad Boys 2, everybody should watch.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited for Little Women or Bad Boys for Life or Doolittle.
Yeah, little
Bad
Boys.
Whatever God has in store for me.
Doolittle Women. We're just thinking about
that. Oh, boy. All right. Well, on that note, please buy our merchandise in the store. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, etc.
Send a postcard to Brian Williams.
Yeah, send a postcard to Brian Williams. You can follow my movie diaries at Letterboxd username D Leo. What if I can change my username just to be my name?
Probably.
Yeah, D Leo is good, but Dan Leo could really take it up to the next level.
Yeah, I'm going to change my name to Dan Leo on Letterboxd.
I'll file an injunction on you right now, as soon as we get off the pod. Rob, how do people follow your movies?
Follow me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Robert Jr. JR. I'll be tweeting Joker Oscars updates every day until it wins all 11 categories.
Yeah, oh man, just wait for the Oscars sweep of Joker.
Oh,
you know
boy.
It's coming.
They're gonna turn the Oscar statues into little Joaquin Phoenixes like dancing on the stairs.
Can we go out to Rock and Roll Part 2?
Oh, please.
Yes, alright, well, until next week, nuts. It's been real.
Bye.
Bye.